Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, I want to take this time to thank you for joining us once again. If this is your first time, please sit back, make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, lasting health, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I am so grateful to have met and worked with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, everybody out there that's listening, you can all do me a big favor. Please check out some of our past shows at answersforthefamily.com to hear some informative and entertaining guests, as well as dynamic co-hosts discuss ways for you and your loved ones to become happier, healthier, and more at peace. Now, and I can tell you right now that when you listen to this one, it is going to help you become happier, healthier, and more at peace. So wait till this one's done and then check out a few more. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group or someone you know that can benefit from a particular subject. I want you to know that we truly appreciate it, and this is just another way that we, together, can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, as we start the show, we start now with the question that is on many people's mind, and that is, where in the world is Gabriella? Well, she's been with us here in Southern California lately, so she's been in studio. Unfortunately, she is in the dentist chair, so she is not going to be able to be with us. She has started her travels again. And for anybody out there, if you have a group and you're the person who is booking speakers, this is somebody you want to have. In every situation that I have seen her speak, it can be a school, it can be a college, a Rotary group, Kiwanis, whatever it is, if there's a group out there, having somebody come in that talks about how to dare to be kind, it raises everybody's spirits. Everybody walks out of there, and I've heard from some of them afterwards that have said that they walk out of this situation and they can't wait to show an act of kindness to someone else. So if that isn't how to book a top speaker, I don't know what is. So now I want to share another thing that she's doing, and that is something that I've said for many years, is that we need much more positive TV shows. And I'm excited about the fact that she has started one. So I'm a firm believer, if we as viewers give our attention, which is our eyeballs or our ears, to shows like hers, something that is based on kindness, it will improve the overall wellness of the world. Now, and if millions of us watch, advertisers will follow. If the advertisers follow, so will the networks. So, you know, that's the type of thing that we can do. We need to make a difference. If everybody continues to watch, you know, train wreck television, well, guess what? Advertisers are going to go where the eyeballs are. So if you want to really make a difference, and I know that we're all out there working as hard as we can, working within the environment that we have at this time, this is a way in which we can all make a difference, and together we will. So for that, and obviously I wish Gabriella well, I know that the dentist isn't one of my favorite places. So now I gave you a little bit in regards to a teaser in regards to what our show was going to be today, but it might not have been enough for you to know what it is, because our show today is based on our guest book, Panic Free. It's a new book that offers a 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but as time has gone on, I think that it's something that many of us now find ourselves dealing with. I know that I was surprised to find out as I did a research that it's estimated that 6 million Americans suffer with some form of panic disorder. And according to our guest, you know, when you start to experience panic, you may try to control your reaction consciously, but that may not work. And it's for two reasons. First, your capacity for conscious thought, which is located in the cortex, breaks down when stress hormones build up. And secondly, conscious thought may not activate the parasympathetic nerve system that we need to be able to calm us down. So take a deep breath in, let it out slowly, relax, and we're going to learn a little bit more about this. And we're going to discuss this with our guest, which is Tom Bunn. He's an LCSW who is the author of the book that I just mentioned, Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia, which is the result of his many years addressing flight panic in his role as an airline pilot. He is also a licensed therapist, regular contributor to Psychology Today, and a former U.S. Air Force captain who flew the Air Force's first supersonic jet fighter, the F-100. Tom, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Well, I'm excited to have you here, but one of the first questions that came to my mind when I started reading the book, but what inspired you for your quest to help panic sufferers coming from that position of being an airline pilot? How did you make this particular jump?
Well, the airline I first worked with was Pan Am. They're out of business now. But at Pan Am, one of our captains had a fear of flying program, and I joined him on that program as a volunteer. And he told people that if they used breathing exercises, that would control their feelings when on the plane, provided they also knew how safe flying was. But it didn't work out. We would do what was called a graduation flight at the end of the course. In many cases, people were on that flight doing their breathing exercises exactly as we taught them, and yet at the same time in a full-blown panic attack. So it was not a pretty sight. And I said to the guy who was running the course, we needed to find some better techniques. And the first thing I suggested was cognitive behavioral therapy. And he said, we'll do it, but it never happened. So finally, I broke off from that course and set up my own and added cognitive tools, thinking that this was going to be the answer. But as you mentioned in the intro, when we get highly stressed, when we get to the state of panic, we're overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. We don't have any cognition left to do anything extra with, such as a cognitive tool. So it became clear that if we were going to fix this, it was going to have to be something that would work automatically and unconsciously. So that was the beginning of the quest.
Now, I know that there are some medications that are targeted for this particular area. I'm not a big medication person. In fact, Big Pharma knows I'm not really their biggest fan. But, you know, can meditation really relieve panic?
Well, wait a minute. I missed. Did you say medication or meditation?
Medication.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, the research, hasn't been a lot of research on fear of flying and panic, although the research that was done showed that when people take these meds, they actually get more hyper-aroused, at least in terms physiologically. They may not be as aroused psychologically, but they get more hyper-aroused physically, and that tends over time to cause them to become more sensitized to the thing that's bothering them. So in the long run, it backfires, and it doesn't work.
So, in terms of
panic on the ground, then some people find they can take the same amount of Xanax or Ativan over a long period of time and get some help. And others find that know that they have to increase the dosage, and it gets to the point that they take as much as they're allowed to, and it still doesn't fix the panic.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, and I've known some people that had a fear of flying, and they told me that they took certain medications. But it seemed to me, and when I had talked with them afterwards, that eventually they stopped doing that because the side effects were eventually worse than the anxiety they were having about flying. Does that sound about right?
Well, I don't know what side effects they were talking about, but what I've heard from many people I've worked with who started trying to fly using Xanax or Ativan, at the first flight or two, they didn't get the help they were looking for, but they were able to get through it. But over time, it came to the point that it wasn't doing anything for them. And then since they weren't getting any benefit, the kind of hangover effect, they didn't like that.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, and I'd mentioned a little bit about anxiety also in the introduction, and I know you talk about it in your book, but share with everybody, because I liked the way that you worded it, but share the difference between anxiety and panic.
Well, in anxiety, you have something in mind that you're afraid is going to happen, but you're clear that it's not happening right now. You're afraid it will happen, and that causes some stress hormone release, and the stress hormones can cause some increased heart rate and breathing rate, some tension. Okay, that's anxiety. In panic, the person shifts from thinking the thing may happen to the thing is happening. It's happening right now. And why is that? The thing that they're in panic about is not happening. But when enough stress hormones build up, we lose the ability to separate what's imaginary from what's real. And so they can imagine, to start out with, that they're afraid something bad's going to happen. But then if they get enough stress hormones, it catches up with them, and they believe that it's happening right now. That's the first part of panic. The second part, there's no escape. So you have to have what you believe, although it's probably not true. You believe it's a life-threatening situation or a situation that could harm you in some way. And secondly, there's no way to get out of it. Those two things are the two main elements of panic.
Okay, so you're saying then that an imagined danger can cause the panic more easily than the real danger. So share more a little bit about that.
Well, that's actually true, and it's really interesting. I had a client, fear flying client, some years ago, and it was a phone session to try to get everything tuned up just right. And I guess in a way I was kind of being a smart aleck. I said, well, have you ever been in a real life-threatening situation expecting him to come up with something that obviously wasn't? And he was an attorney in New York City. He said, yes. I said, well, what was it? Still being a bit of a smart aleck. He said, a client came into my office and put a gun to my head. Well, that changed everything.
Yes.
Okay, so you've been in a real life-threatening situation. And so then I thought, all right, so here's the question then. In that life-threatening situation, while you had the gun to your head, on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being totally relaxed and 10 maxed out, where were you? And he said, I was at a 3. He said, but I came in to work the next day, and I went right up to a 10. I was a complete basket case. I couldn't do anything. So I went home, came back the following day. Same thing happened. Couldn't do anything. So this kind of illustrates the difference. In real life, a real-life situation gives you a shot of stress hormones, and it revs you up a little bit, usually, as he found, on a scale of 0 to 10, about a 3. But what happened the next day? The next day, his imagination kicks in. The gun's not to his head, but he imagines, what if the guy had pulled the trigger? Step one. That causes some stress hormones. Mm-hmm. Takes it maybe to a 3 again. Mm-hmm. And then he thinks, I'd be lying right here on the floor. And that causes some additional stress hormones to be released. He goes up to a 4 or 5, and he thinks they're going to call the medic. Somebody's going to come in and rush me to the hospital. He pictures himself in an ambulance, possibly unconscious, possibly conscious. He pictures, even if he's unconscious, being in an emergency room. That takes him up maybe to a 7, and he figures someone's going to call his wife. She's going to have a big reaction to this, not knowing if he's going to live or not. That takes him up to a 10, maybe. So it's these thoughts, one after another, which are imaginary, that can take us up to a level where we lose the difference between what's real and what's imaginary and go into a state of panic. And also, in that state, believe there's nothing we can do to get out of it.
So Well, share with us then what your method does that allows us to, I guess, not go through those phases to where it takes us to that point, or is it sort of keeping us in a sense of reality, kind of bringing us back to, you know, this is really all that happened? How does it work?
Well, it is that, but you can't really do that cognitively. What we do is train ahead of time. They say of people who do high stress jobs, life and death kinds of situations, firefighters, policemen, emergency medical people, in a very high stress situation, we don't think as clearly as we do when we're cool, calm, and collected. So in those situations, it said you don't rise to the occasion. You don't become more capable in the emergency. You descend to the level of your training, because in those situations, you don't get sharper, you get duller. So what you have to depend on is being able to go to the things you have done to practice step by step by step canned procedures for whatever the situation is you're facing. So they know what kind of situations firefighters face, policemen mm-hmm. face, emergency room people do. So they have a list of procedures for each of the very high stress situations they could be under. The person goes through them again and again and again until it's built into what we call unconscious procedural memory.
Gotcha.
Now, to suggest then, as people are listening, they don't say, I don't know anything about unconscious procedural memory. Well, actually, you know all about it if you drive a car. Mm-hmm. When you first learned to drive a car, it was difficult. But over time, a part of your brain in the subcortex, the memory system in the subcortex, unconscious procedural memory, absorbs the things you do when you drive the car. So these days, now that unconscious procedural memory has taken in what you do to drive the car, it can take over and drive the car for you, kind of like a mental autopilot while you have a conversation with someone as you drive. So what we want to do, because we've already spoken how in a state of panic, you can't then rise to the occasion and do anything, because it's almost like, in some case, it really is a deer in a headlight situation. You become frozen. So what we have to do is prepare ahead of time what kind of things we want to go on at an unconscious level in the brain to keep panic from developing to that point. So what we do is we train the mind to do two things. Mm-hmm. And if we know a situation where you know that you could panic, such as an MRI or a bridge or tunnel mm-hmm. or high place, we take that situation and break it down into a series of steps. For example, MRI, you're going to make an appointment. You're going to go there. You're going to check in. You're going to be taken to a room to put on a robe. Then you go into the room where the MRI machine is. You're going to lie down. You're going to wait. Then the machine's going to start operating and push you through the tube a little bit, halfway through, three quarters of the way through, then out. So we take those maybe 8 or 10 steps and we do something to prevent the release of stress hormones when you're in that situation. We link those things that you're going to run into to a memory of a time when you produced a protective hormone called oxytocin. When you produce oxytocin, you can't produce stress hormones. So by setting up a link between the thing you're going to do and the production of this protective hormone, as you do this thing, the protective hormone keeps you from getting revved up. So that's the one of the things we want to link to.
Okay, well, and let me ask you about the oxytocin, because one of the things that I have wondered about actually for a long time is, and you've mentioned that one of the things, which is why people that are in a profession that they need to be able to respond, that you're using repetition, because then it's something, mm-hmm. you know, but if you have for the rest of the world, I think you may have just explained it, but I'm not sure that I've got it, but there are some people that no matter, no matter what the situation is, and I think I'm actually one of those, that when that life or death situation happens and when that things go into slow motion, it actually, it's just the opposite of somebody who is the, you know, the what would you say? The, you know, the dough with their, with,
overwhelmed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Overwhelmed. Or
you go into this slow motion and things slow down and you're able to act. And that does happen for people. And I think that's because they have a built-in system so that when they get hit with stress hormones, they automatically get calmed down. You know, when your cell phone rings and you answer it, it calms down so that you can have that conversation. Now, people who panic are more like a cell phone that when it rings and you answer it, it keeps ringing. When they get a shot of stress hormones, they stay revved up for a couple of minutes until the stress hormones burn off. So all that time, they're not thinking clearly. On the other hand, if you have this circuitry, like your cell phone does, when you get zapped with stress hormones, you get a momentarily feeling of alarm, and then you quiet way down so that you can think clearly. And I think that's the difference. You have that circuitry so that when you're in a high-stress situation, you get a momentary feeling of alarm, and then you're actually able to handle it beautifully.
So, but is that what you were talking about when you brought up the oxytocin?
Yeah, when you get well, there's two things.
Yeah.
Oxytocin prevents the release of stress hormones, and if we know the situation you're going to be in, we can link oxytocin-producing memory to each of those steps so that as you do that activity, you keep getting oxytocin. The other thing, and this is where what we were just talking about, how you get this automatic calming that takes place. Even though you get stress hormones, you can override the stress hormones if you can activate what's called the parasympathetic nervous system.
Okay.
Stephen Porges, researcher and professor of psychiatry at the University of North Carolina now, discovered that when we're with other people, we send and receive signals unconsciously all the time. And the signals that we pick up from other people have an effect on us, potentially a calming effect on us. We pick up signals from the area around the eyes. We pick up signals from the quality of the person's voice and from their body language or touch. You know, when a child gets upset, a mother or a caregiver presents her face. That has a calming effect. It activates the child's parasympathetic nervous system. Child's born with the system, not with software to operate it. So mom's got to turn it on. So she does it first with her face. She does it second with the sound of her voice. Baby doesn't understand those words, but the parasympathetic nervous system responds to the quality of her voice. And then touch, being held, being rocked, being caressed. So those three things calm the baby. Mm-hmm. Here we are, fast forward to being an adult. In a situation where we need to be calmed, we need to find someone currently in our life or recently in our life who has that effect on us. When we're with them, their face is sending us signals that we have nothing to fear from them. Their voice is sending us those safety signals, and their touch or body language is sending us those safety signals. So that when we're with that kind of a person, that would be a person who's not a threat in any way physically, and not a threat in any way psychologically. A person who is, well, as you mentioned, Gabrielle talking about dare to be kind, a person who doesn't judge other people, a person who just accepts you just as you are. And when that signal comes across, if you're picking it up and processing it properly, you're going to feel your guard let down. So that's what we're looking for, to override the effect of stress hormones. So the first thing we want to link to oxytocin production in the situation you're going to run into. We also want to link and bring a memory of a person who's calming into that experience so that if we do get some stress hormones, that person becomes psychologically active as an inner resource. You know, sometimes when we're with a person we know, we feel calmer. But we want to take a person that we can build inside so that person is transportable. Wherever we go, we have that inner resource that we can bring that person's face, voice, and touch to bear on the situations that cause stress.
All right. We are talking with Tom Bunn. He is the author of Panic Free, the 10-Day Program to End Panic, Anxiety, and Claustrophobia. We have a listener call that's coming in. This one is going to be directed about someone who is saying that their mother is afraid to fly, as well as having anxiety around traveling in any form of vehicle. So stay with us. We're going to ask Tom to address that as soon as we get back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking with Tom Bunn, and we are talking about panic attacks. So the question that has just come in, and this one reads, my mother is very afraid to fly, and she has anxiety around traveling in any vehicle outside of a certain radius of our hometown. There is also many places I would love to take her, but she just refuses to even discuss it. I read on Alan's site that your book can be helpful with this specific issue. I ordered your book, but in the meantime, can you talk about what causes these triggers? And this is from Catherine in Virginia.
Okay. What causes these triggers is the amygdala, the part of the brain that releases stress hormones. According to Stephen Porges, he says it's at least a couple of hundred million years old. If you go back to that period of time, the most advanced creatures were reptiles. You think of a huge reptile like a dinosaur, Tyrannosaurus Rex, had a brain the size of a dog. Not much brain power, but he did have an amygdala. So how he protects himself, but not very good at protecting himself intellectually, so he does it reflexively. The amygdala senses what's going on. As long as everything stays the same and there's no change, the amygdala stays quiet. But if there's any change, if anything happens that's unexpected or not familiar, the amygdala fires off stress hormones. The stress hormones cause an urge to run, creature runs away. So Porges refers to this as the mobilization system. Run or fight if there's any change that happens, which might be a threat. Now, when mammals came on the scene, mm-hmm. Now the brain got much larger. Now there's a thinking part of the brain. Still, we, like other mammals, inherited the amygdala, and it operates pretty much the same as it did back 200 million years ago. When it senses change, it produces stress hormones. We get an urge to run. However, our high-level thinking, sometimes referred to as executive function, is activated, and our high-level thinking says, okay, I've got this feeling that I'm uncomfortable here, but wait a minute, I don't want to just run like a chicken with my head cut off, because now I've got this big head. I've got this intelligence. Let me take a look and see if I really need to run. Don't need all those false alarms where we just run for everything. So the high-level thinking surveys the situation. If it can say, oh, this is what caused the release of stress hormones, that's not a problem. Or this is what caused the release of stress hormones. Yeah, it's a threat, but I can deal with that threat. Or it might say, yeah, the best thing to do is run. So to answer the question, what happens with the release of stress hormones, it's the amygdala firing off the stress hormones, and we don't have enough information to be sure that we're safe. Now, part of what feeds in here is that when we get stressed, we don't think clearly enough to really assess our risk situation accurately. On the airplane, for example, you don't have very much information. You feel the plane drop. That's automatically going to release stress hormones. The amygdala reacts to the feeling of dropping. So then the feeling stressed, and it's not just one drop. It's one drop after another, after another, after another. So the stress hormones build up. One shot of stress hormones would just give you a mild increase in heart rate and breathing rate, but 10 shots can just drive you off the wall. And when you get pounding heart and rapid breathing and sweatiness and tension, it becomes very hard to say, oh, I'm sure everything's fine. So in a way, it makes sense on an airplane to not feel comfortable unless you built in some resources to override those stress hormones or to prevent getting them in the first place. Now, I think what happens with the caller's mother is that when she is in control and has information, she, like we other mammals, can say, okay, yeah, this is an okay situation because I have enough control. And if I don't get enough control and things go wrong, I can still escape. She may feel that she can do that in a certain radius where she's still in home base and it feels familiar to her. But if she gets outside of a familiar area, her amygdala is just going to fire off because it's not familiar. And then she's going to continuously get stress hormones just because she's in a place that's not familiar to her.
Well, first of all, I want to add that Gabriella has joined us. So, Gabriella, glad to have you on.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I'm good. And we're on with Tom. And so, Tom, but a question in regards to what you just said is that what are some of the things that we can do from the standpoint of bringing in things that are more familiar? If you know, you're talking about the thing yeah. about familiarity, I'm envisioning starting with, you know, a small child that, you know, that needs to have their blankie with them, you know, and that, you know, when they travel, because it makes them feel better because they have yeah. something familiar. How do we now adjust that to fit for the average adult?
Well, okay, what I'm saying is the unfamiliarity is what fires off the amygdala.
Right.
And one of the treatments that's often used is to try to make things familiar through desensitization. But it's pretty tricky to try to desensitize to all the things that could happen on the plane, probably impossible. So what we do instead of desensitizing to keep the amygdala from firing off, we produce oxytocin periodically during the flight. We aim for every 5 minutes or so that we keep producing oxytocin continuously enough that the amygdala is really off duty. So we don't have to desensitize the amygdala if we just turn it off.
Okay. So, Gabriella, you were just in the dentist chair. That's one of the places where I have the most anxiety.
I can understand, by the way.
So what questions might you have for Tom on that side?
Well, I was going to ask Tom something, actually. Obviously, I just came into the conversation, and I apologize if you've maybe already answered this question, but you just said how to prevent, and I forgot the word, of firing off. What was the word again?
Well, the amygdala fires off stress hormones, and we produce oxytocin, it just takes a nap and can't do that.
What happens to people like me? I travel every day. I don't have a comfort zone because everywhere I go is a strange place, like being in a plane. And it seems mm-hmm. like I kind of thrive on it. But what does that mean for a person like me? Does that mean that amygdala never gets fired off in my case?
No, I think it fires off. I think what happens is that when the amygdala is going to react anytime it notices something it's not used to. However, some of us who are really fortunate in our early formative years, whenever we were upset, we were responded to. So we felt secure that if I get upset, mom's going to take care of it. And I think what happens at around 18 months is, and by the way, we talked a little bit about this earlier, that Stephen Porges discovered that when we're with another person, if it's the right kind of person, a person who's not a physical threat, not an emotional threat, person who's not even judgmental, when we're with that kind of person, their face, their voice, and their body language activates our calming system, turns on the parasympathetic nervous system, overrides stress hormones. Okay.
Yep.
Now, if you're a little kid and you're 18 months old, and at about that point, you now, when you're upset, you know you can expect your mom to show up. And so as you start to cry and she's in a different room, you know she'll be here in a minute. You picture she's going to come around the corner. You're going to see that wonderful face. She's going to say, honey, what's wrong? And she's going to come over and give you a hug. Well, guess what? The mom's not there yet, but the child's imagining the mom. The imagination activates the calming system. Mm-hmm. Now, if mom then shows up and finds the child is calm, she could say, hey, come on, I was busy, stop bothering me, and walk away. That wouldn't reinforce what the child just did to calm itself. But if mom does say, hey, you were just upset, I'm here, let me give you a hug anyway, I'd love to hug you, are you okay now? You sure? Then mom reinforces what the child has just serendipitously done to calm itself. And that then gets built in to what I call automatic attenuation, automatic regulation, where when you get stress hormones, you get just this moment of feeling revved up and instantly go into a calmed down state where you can think calmly. That's what I believe is happening for you.
Not for me, but I do understand what you're saying, but I've never had that. So because we don't know each other, you can't know that. But I lived in an orphanage for the first 3 years, so life was not mm-hmm. comfortable. It was mm-hmm. truly quite scared. Scary environment. Everything was different every day. So mm-hmm. there were no parents to pick up the child. So that's why I'm asking this question. Why would
yes, but you like may me, have... You may have had someone at some later time that gave you that.
Nope.
I can give you an example.
The answer is truly no. No.
Hmm?
Okay. I'm just curious.
Then I don't know then how you would have the inner resources to regulate yourself then, unless you just feel in control.
Yeah, see, this is why I love that you talked about the imagination. See, I believe in the power of visualization, that you yourself can actually say, I'm safe, it doesn't matter. That you can project that. Alan, can you?
Oh, well,
what
yeah.
do you think?
Well, in fact, what I was just thinking when you were saying that was, you know, very similar to what Tom said when he said that, you know, the child imagined that. But I think that in your case, because you didn't have those things around you, the child imagined who they knew brings that. But because you didn't have that, you created your own. And,
yep.
and, which I think is beautiful, but, you know, so as the young child that creates their own, they don't really need then to rely upon somebody else to reinforce it, because at some young age, you determined that you were going to create a method or a platform that worked for you. That would be my thought. But again, because of the fact that there are millions of us out there, I'm sure that there's a variety of different ways that we, that we choose to make things work based on the environment we're in.
That's why I kind of love that you talked about the imagination. I think that's probably so powerful what you just said, that everyone knows that we can bring that in to help us at all times.
Yeah, let me tell you about some research that was fairly new. It came out this spring from the University of Arizona. They took 102 people who were in committed relationships. I'm assuming they were students there at the school. And they used them as research subjects. They wanted to try three different interventions to see how much benefit each of those interventions would be in a stressful situation. The stressful situation. What was it? Putting your foot in 38-degree water. Now, it doesn't sound terrible, but two people dropped out of the experiment saying, no, I don't want to do it. But anyway, the first group, the intervention was, while your foot is in the water, of course, they had them hooked up to monitoring to see how stressed they were.
Okay.
When the foot was in the water, think about what you did today, which is distraction.
Mm-hmm.
The second group, they told them, think about the person you're in a romantic relationship with. They measured them. The third group, they actually had their romantic partner physically present and measured them. Now, you know that that group is probably going to get a good benefit. The amazing thing in the research was the people who simply thought about their partner did just as good as the ones who had the partner present. So do you see, if we bring to mind a calming person and attach that calming person to the challenge, we have something that works.
Beautiful.
I like it.
I love that you said that. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. So that really means that our imagination is as powerful as having the real deal.
Well,
in many ways.
I'm going back again to Stephen Porges, because he discovered that the three things that about another person that will activate the calming system are signals that come unconsciously from around their face and eyes.
Yeah.
Quality of their voice and their body language or touch. And so there may be other things, but we know about those. So if we visualize those things, we know we have something that's calming. You know, sometimes I have a client, fear flying client, who says, well, I feel comfortable when I'm at the beach, so I'm going to link being at the beach to being on the airplane. Well, I think the reason they feel comfortable at the beach, there's not anything happening to bother them. Of course, the surf and sound, that can have a calming effect. But basically, nothing's going on to upset them. What I'm looking for is something that will calm you down when there is something going on to upset you. So you need something to counteract it. The two things: keep from getting revved up with oxytocin production, override the stress hormones with activation of the calming system, the parasympathetic nervous system. By the way, when we first started the show, Alan, you were talking about taking a deep breath and letting it out slowly.
When you exhale,
you activate the vagus nerve, which slows the heart rate and breathing rate and causes relaxation. The only problem is you have to breathe back in. So what happens, though, if you're with a person whose face and voice and quality and touch, or you remember that person, as long as that person is active in your awareness, or you're remembering that person, it's like an exhale that lasts as long as you're with them. Both activate the vagus nerve.
I like that.
Now, I love breath. I love that you mentioned that, because that was my next question. I use breath a lot.
Yep.
Because I believe that any fearful moment, if you use breath, I always say the moment is over. The moment you breathe out, that moment has already passed.
Good point.
Well, yeah, because at that moment, you slow the heart rate and breathing rate. And the question is, if you can feel that you only need that break for the 10 seconds you're exhaling, and that's enough to stop the problem. Yeah, that's great. My thinking is that I can't depend on the people I work with to be mindful enough to put that into action. So what I want them to do is to train ahead of time so that this kicks in automatically.
Of course.
Okay. Now, one of the questions that I have is that what would the one thing, what do you think is the most important thing that a person in the midst of a panic attack needs to know? And for somebody that is with them, what is the one thing that they can do? So I want everybody that's listening to be able to have a takeaway, to walk away and then tell somebody else that they know and go, you know what? I now know if somebody's having a panic attack, this is the first thing I'm going to do.
So the first thing to know is, if you're the person having a panic attack, there's probably not much you can do unless you can escape.
Okay.
And sometimes you can't even do that because you get frozen. But the person who's with you, if they can recognize you're in a panic attack, and they might be able to do that because your eyes are probably focused 1,000 miles away. If they can then get right in your face, I mean, put their face in front of yours, maybe 8 inches, and hold up some fingers between the two faces, like two fingers, to say, hey, look at my fingers, count them. How many fingers is that? Come on. The person's not going to respond. You have to keep demanding. Come on, tell me, how many fingers is that? And they finally say, two, and then you change it to four or three, and you keep asking that until they pull out of their imagination into the reality of how many fingers there are. And then you point to some object. What's the name of that? What color is that? And when you bring the person back from there, deep into their imagination, back to what's really real there, it reminds me of what you just said about breathing, Gabriella. If the breathing can pull them that quickly out, fine, but I think it may take longer. And so if you're a friend there who can apply this intervention, it might take 20 seconds to pull them out, then they're out. But the other thing a person can do is to train their unconscious procedural memory to nip panic in the bud so that you never get to that point. Here's something your listeners could do on their own. First, think through the people you know and see if you can identify a person who, when you're with them, you do feel completely at ease. If you have a person like that, that person's going to be sending you signals, face, voice, and touch, body language, that will activate your calming system. Okay, you got what you need to activate your calming system, that person. So for the next few days, instead of trying to not be aware of anxiety or being alarmed, look for it. As soon as you can pick it up, see if you can pick up the release of stress hormones as soon as it happens. And before you do anything else, imagine that person just walked into the room, says hello to you, and comes over and gives you a hug. So do you see? You are answering arousal, being revved up, being alarmed, being stressed. You're arousing it, responding to it immediately by bringing in what calms us, what activates the calming system, another person's face, voice, and touch. Then if you do this a few dozen times in the next few days, it'll become automatic. And that's what I'm looking for, something that will work automatic. So you don't have to remember to do anything or run the risk of having to do something when you're in a state of panic and might not be able to do it.
First of all, I absolutely love that, because what I hear you saying is that not only are you changing you're changing the focus, but you're also doing it in an incredibly positive way and adding in somebody that you care about and you trust and you're hugging. That whole combination is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
And can I also say that what you explained about the focus with asking questions about something totally different, like how many fingers am I holding up? I have used that technique without even knowing it was a technique, but just because I got stuck with my own father who has Alzheimer. So I've used that in his own, I guess you would say, panic attack, where they panic because they don't know where they are, right? They don't know that they're in a hospital, or in their unlucid moments, they kind of go a little bit off, right? And I had one hand firmly on his shoulder. He was lying in the hospital, but firmly, not meanly, but firmly. And my face was about 8 inches away from him. And then I kept asking questions. So I love that you said that, because it really worked. It really worked.
So you've got the touch, you've got the quality of your voice, and you're also bringing him out of imagination into something that's just not threatening in any way, but just an object. What's the name of that thing? What color is that? What color are my eyes? How many fingers do I have? Just basic stuff that's going on that has no threat value at all. It's just stuff that you can bring yourself to get away from being locked into your imaginary disaster.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, Gabriella, time has flown by. And I wish that we had more time. We don't, but what I'd like to do, Tom, I haven't done this before. There is another listener question that has come in. Can I ask you that?
Okay, sure.
Can I ask you that?
Yeah.
Can you send me the answer? In other words, like email it or something.
Yes.
If you can send me the answer. So what I'm going to tell everybody out there is you're going to hear this question. We need you to go to the website. We'll post the answer there. Okay. So this one reads, I work with a 24-hour care team for a woman who is 77 years old and has a serious bipolar condition. She is in a continual loop. stating that she is scared and anxious nearly all the time. Her general health is stable, and there are no memory issues. But this anxiety is so pronounced that she is considered a suicide risk. She seeks a psychiatrist. She sees a psychiatrist twice a week, and is on the typical medications for this disorder. But nothing is really helping her. Let's see. I'm trying to get to the. Do you think there is hope for a person such as this? And would your book give us some possible ways to help her? And this is from Wendy in Louisiana.
Yeah, well, this is something I'm not sure about, but I would assume that even a person who's bipolar still has the parasympathetic nervous system. And the question is, how can we activate it? So what I would try, and I'll answer an email, but what I would try is using face, voice, and body language to see if those will activate the person's calming system.
Thank you.
And Reiki.
And Reiki, there's another one.
Reiki uses the parasympathetic, can get the parasympathetic going really easily.
Yes.
A good Reiki master can do it.
All right.
Yeah.
So for everybody out there.
You might even be able to link to that person's face, voice, and touch. Yes.
All right. Well, again, thank you to both of you for being on. Again, I wish we had more time. And for everybody else out there, please be sure to put on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we're going to be joined by Jaina Dixon to discuss Thrival, and I'm pronouncing that correctly, in the Chemtrail Holocaust. I've got to tell you, if anybody is thinking about what's going on in the sky, and you've heard people talk about this, and I'm going to have an incredible co-host as well that has also studied this for many, many years. So tune in. And if you get the chance to go to our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, please do so. Be good human beings, everybody out there. Share this with everybody. Go to the Dare to Be Kind movement Facebook page. If you want to get a hold of Tom, you can go to his website, which is panicfree.net. You can order the book anywhere. Thank you both for being with us. And for everybody, join us again next week.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.